Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. When the state of Arizona cut funding for organ and bone marrow transplants in October, it was the first state to do so, and you had to wonder, could it happen here? Most folks can't afford the price tag for such operations, usually hundreds of thousands of dollars. Most of them rely on the government to fund them. Republicans in Arizona said it was necessary to make that cut given a billion-dollar shortfall in the state budget. Democrats charged that eliminating the $5 million program from the state's multi-billion-dollar budget was immoral. Later in the show, we're going to talk about the economics of medical care for uninsured patients in Ohio and how transplant cases are handled here. We'll also look at how federal health care reform will impact states facing massive budget deficits and increased demand for Medicaid right now. We're going to hear from Arizona Governor Jan Brewer on this recorded Q&A with a reporter last fall.
It's only $5 million. You must be able to find it somewhere else.
I wish that, I've got a $1 billion deficit facing the state of Arizona. The bottom line is we simply don't have the money. I would suggest that people would go to the federal government and ask them to send us stimulus dollars to support these transplants if that's what they want.
They sent you nearly $200 million in stimulus dollars. Why can't you use those for the transplant patients?
$200 million that they were sent to, Arizona, and they have been expended in a proper manner.
Joining us now is Michelle Lee. Michelle is a reporter for the Arizona Republic. She covered the state's cuts to transplant coverage this fall. Welcome to the show, Michelle.
Hi, thanks for having me, Ann.
The funding cut for transplants amounts to about $5 million, but it affects the lives of 100 Arizona residents. How did state officials make this decision?
Well, the state has an unbalanced budget, and the enrollment in our version of Medicaid, which is the Arizona Health Cost Containment System, we call it ACCESS, the enrollment grew tremendously, and that led to budget cuts to the agency. The legislator cut a bunch of services that are optional per federal guidelines, which means our state Medicaid agency doesn't need to cover. And this included coverage for certain types of transplants for adults who are 21 and over. And these transplants included some liver, lung, heart, and bone marrow transplants.
There was criticism about the data that the legislature used to make these decisions about which transplants to cut and which to keep.
Right. Well, there are some suggestions that these cuts may have been made based on inaccurate or outdated data because ACCESS, talking specifically about transplants, ACCESS based a lot of their data on their own patients and their own experience with transplants and their survival rates. And they backed it up with national data, too. But a lot of transplant doctors and organizations are saying that the national data that they use are old, like some are from the 90s, and that it's not accurate to only use data based on your own internal patients. And some legislators are saying that they plan to revisit these data in the upcoming session. So it's not exactly clear what, the accuracy of the data, but it is in question.
What were the folks who are involved in the transplant, screening transplant patients and getting transplants accomplished, the doctors, the surgeons, the medical systems, were they aware that this was something that was on the chopping block?
It seems they were, because this isn't the first time that transplant cuts have been discussed or even put on the table.
Mm-hmm.
And when I spoke with a transplant doctor a few months ago, he said that he and a few other doctors had submitted, other data to support the survival rate success of transplant patients, of bone marrow transplant patients specifically, because he takes care of bone marrow transplant patients. And he said that, he and a couple other doctors submitted the data. And when I asked the governor's office about it, they said, we're not quite sure whether we received it. Just, we receive a lot of information and documents and phone calls and emails, so they couldn't speak specifically on whether they received that data.
Mm-hmm.
But it does seem like it's been on the table for a while.
Was anybody in Arizona prepared for some of the fallout or across the country when the New York Times story hit on this?
Well, we weren't expecting that much national coverage from, at least from my perspective. Mm-hmm. I've been covering this for a while, but it's been a very local issue. The public has been very concerned about these cuts. Every time I write these stories, which has been since the cuts went into effect on October 1st, you know, there was a patient who lost his chance at a bone marrow transplant mm-hmm. the day after the cuts went into effect. You know, he found two donor matches on October 2nd, and he couldn't afford the surgery anymore because it was no longer covered. And, you know, as soon as I wrote those stories, I would receive a lot of emails from readers and calls, just people concerned or upset or just wanting to know how to donate. So it's been on everyone's radar here in Arizona, but it's taken off nationally.
There was the fellow who actually had a relative who was dying who was going to donate an organ for his benefit, and he wasn't even allowed to use that.
Yeah, he was a liver disease patient, liver disease as a result of hepatitis C, which is a specific liver transplant that's no longer covered through ACCESS.
Mm-hmm.
And my understanding is that it's difficult to receive liver transplants, organ transplants in general, because the demand is just so much greater than the supply. But in his case, you know, the average wait time on a liver transplant wait list is like 2 years. And he had been on the wait list since April, but his wife, or it was a family friend who was dying and wanted to donate her liver to Francisco Felix, that's his name.
Mm-hmm.
She wanted to donate it specifically to Mr. Felix, and so they prepped him for surgery, and it had to be done within a very specific amount of time because, or else, you know, the organ would deteriorate. So he was ready to go. He was prepped for surgery, but the doctors told him to come up with $200,000 basically overnight because they found out at, like, 10 p.m., and then the surgery was prepped for 10 a.m. the next day. And he reached out to media. Democratic legislators made a big deal out of it. They called all of us, emailed all of us, but mm-hmm. there was only so much we can do from the press side. And he couldn't come up with $200,000, and the liver went to the next patient who was on the list.
How is he now?
He's okay. When I speak with his wife, she tells me that he's doing okay. Doctors expect him to be healthy enough to receive another transplant procedure for the next year and a half or so. Yeah.
The 100 people were affected by this. How many people in Arizona are waiting for transplants? What percentage of the people waiting actually are affected by this?
I'm not quite sure about that.
Mm-hmm.
I do know that about 100 patients who are enrolled in our Medicaid program are on the transplant list.
Mm-hmm.
And what ACCESS does is that only about 15% of these people will actually get a transplant, the actual procedure, or they would qualify to get the procedure because, you know, based on their health or support and whatnot.
In particular, the hepatitis C, the criticism of that was that they based it on faulty data regarding the efficiency or the effectiveness, I should say, of the interferon drug used to treat hepatitis C, that it's mm-hmm. really old data. How does the State Department, was it the State Department of Health that, or the Medicaid?
It was our Medicaid agency. When I looked at the data, it shows the number of people who receive transplants and survive them throughout of, you know, X amount of years. And then they have supplemental data for each type of transplant that was cut based on national data. So I believe the one that ACCESS based on for the liver transplant was a study done in Duke or somewhere,
mm-hmm.
Some similar university mm-hmm. hospital. And it showed that most people don't survive liver transplants if they're hepatitis C patients.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, again, there are all these doctors and organ transplant organizations, national organizations coming out and saying, we're ready to provide accurate and updated data, recent data to Governor Brewer, and we're ready to show that these patients can survive.
Is Governor Brewer ready to reconsider?
Well, her stance has been and continues to be that she wouldn't call a special session unless someone proposes how the state would make up for what she calls a $1 billion gap in the access funding.
Mm-hmm.
Democratic legislators have been asking her to either call a special session or to use her federal discretionary stimulus funds to reinstate the funding, at least for the transplant coverage, which, as you said, is about $4.2 million annualized in both state and federal funds.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, she's set on solving the umbrella budget gap rather than focusing on just reinstating the transplant fund. Her office says that, you know, that would just be a temporary solution that would be giving false hope that, you know, the agency is fine and they're looking forward to a $1 billion solution.
So with those discretionary stimulus dollars, what is she doing with them?
Well, she had told us that they were all allocated and earmarked and that there's just no money in the $185 million discretionary funds. And we had asked her for a breakdown of where the money is, you know, allocated for or earmarked for. And it took a few weeks, but she gave us a list, or her office gave us a list, and it includes, you know, $50 million to backfill cuts for the state prison's budget, $18 million to make up cuts for children's services, $2 million to cover the state's commitment to Teach for America, and other public safety projects, about $10 million for those.
How's the public responding to this? I know I've read stories about kids, you know, doing fundraisers, standing out in the streets, collecting spare change from motorists and that sort of thing.
Right.
What are people in Arizona saying about this?
A lot of people, I think, are mainly concerned for the patients because now there's a face to the budget cuts, you know, or there are faces, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
The student that you're speaking about, Carlos Olivas, he's 12, about to turn 13, and he had wanted to raise $2,500, and so he collected dimes from an intersection, a really busy intersection. He got his school to hold a dress down day, and to, you know, for students to donate at least a dollar if they want to dress down on a Friday, and he exceeded his goal. I believe he raised about $2,700,
mm-hmm.
but you know, that's just a drop in the bucket. These patients each need upwards of, you know, $200,000, $300,000 just for the procedure itself. And, you know, there's a patient down in Tucson who I spoke with who is holding car washes, and he has a band, and they put out a CD, and they're selling it for $10, and a dollar of each CD goes toward funding his surgery. But, you know, these are kind of smaller steps to raising the money. Some of the patients who have been in national news and have been getting a lot of publicity, they got on the National Transplant Assistance Fund, and the fund basically keeps an account, like a fund account for these patients, and anyone can donate money through the website or by phone. And I understand that these patients have raised tens of thousands of dollars that way, especially after they got on MSNBC's Keith Olbermann show.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people are trying to support. They want to support, it seems like. I get a lot of calls, people asking how to donate, and people want to help. And a lot of these people are very concerned or very upset.
And I suppose every day, are they means testing people before they bother to put them on a transplant waiting list to find out if they can afford it?
People on transplant waiting lists, there are three criteria that they have to meet before getting a transplant, and it's, you know, finances, that they could afford the surgery. Another is that they're healthy enough for it, and the third is that they have a support network of family or friends who would, you know, help them post-surgery. And people who meet these criteria and people who really need transplants, that's my understanding of why they're on the wait list, mm-hmm. that they have no other options. And for a lot of these patients, really getting a new organ is their only option. So they're placed on the wait list. But once they can't afford it, they're placed on an inactive waiting list, which means until they can figure out how to pay for it, they wouldn't be able to get an organ. So when I talk to doctors, they say, you know, they want these patients to be on the wait list, and they hope that they would qualify for procedures as much as possible, so they try to keep them on, and then they keep them on the inactive wait list in hopes that they could raise the money to get back on the active wait list.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you, Michelle Lee from the Arizona Republic. Thanks for joining us for this segment of the show.
Of course. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Michelle Lee of the Arizona Republic, she's been covering the issue in Arizona of the state cuts to the transplant program, funding for transplant patients in Arizona. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
This is WOSU 820 NPR News. Tonight on WOSU TV, take a behind-the-scenes look at young Americans, Christian, Jewish, Catholic, and Muslim, preparing to become the nation's next generation of religious leaders. The Calling follows their transformation from idealistic students into ordained religious professionals. This special event explores the forces that are drawing a new generation to serve their communities and their faith. Watch The Calling tonight at 9 on WOSU TV. And it's 27 degrees in downtown Columbus. A few clouds today, a high of 34 degrees. There is a slight chance of snow mixing with freezing rain tonight, a low tonight of 27 degrees. Clouds for Wednesday and a high of 36, and sunshine as we look ahead to Thursday with a high of 31 degrees. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides. Coming up, we hope to welcome Dr. Robert Higgins. He's director of the OSU Medical Center's Comprehensive Transplant Center, where heart, kidney, liver, pancreas, and combined kidney pancreas transplants are performed. He's not with us yet. But with us now is Tiffany Heimelreich of the Ohio Hospital Association. Welcome to the show, Tiffany.
Thanks, Anne. It's great to be on the show.
We will be talking about transplants more, but what we wanted to talk to you about is kind of that overarching concern. Is Ohio next? Transplants, just one category of cuts in Arizona. There were many more. So far, 39 states have cut Medicaid payments to doctors. 20 states have erased optional benefits. Each contraction has consequences. What's happening in Ohio?
Well, the overall state landscape in Ohio, as I'm sure you know, is a little bit dire. We're looking at a projected $8 billion budget hole. And so I think that has all groups, you know, a little bit on edge about mm-hmm. how this budget's going to shake out, certainly not just healthcare providers or, you know, the Medicaid budget. It's certainly a possibility that we could see some eligibility reductions, but there are many possibilities. And, you know, I don't know that the administration has formed its plan just yet. So everyone's sort of waiting with bated breath to see how this plays out.
As long as I've been covering state government, Ohio's hospitals have been juggling indigent care. How do you manage now? How are Ohio hospitals managing the costs of uninsured patients?
Well, what hospitals have to do, you know, in the most recent year, we have data for hospitals provided about $1 billion in charity care, and certainly that has to come from somewhere. Oftentimes, it's cross-subsidized from profitable services, and those are private insurance covers that a bit too. But the burden is getting a little bit more than hospitals can bear in some areas. Certainly, and they're looking to pinch pennies anywhere they can, improve quality in order to be more efficient, and really just run their systems as efficiently as possible.
Now, up in Cleveland, they've stopped serving people outside of certain geographic areas. That's not been the case in Central Ohio yet.
No, not here in Central Ohio. The local hospitals have really banded together on some good charity care programs to make sure that people have those. And certainly the hospitals in Cleveland and around the state do everything that they can. But as I mentioned, it's getting harder for hospitals to have their ends meet. And they're a little bit underpaid by the government on Medicaid and Medicare already. And so, you know, there's charity care and those losses, and they're really just trying to balance all of that with service to their communities.
We want to welcome Dr. Robert Higgins. As I said, he's the director of the OSU Medical Center's Comprehensive Transplant Center. He also leads the Division of Cardiac Surgery, and in 2008-2009 served as president of the United Network for Organ Sharing. Welcome, Dr. Higgins.
Good morning.
Critics of the decision in Arizona to end state funding for certain transplants say that state officials making that decision incorrectly assume that transplants are still largely experimental and high risk. Can you give us a rundown on where the transplants stand in the matrix of experimental and typical?
Thank you for the opportunity. I enjoyed your comments. This is really a timely and really a critically important issue. You know, transplantation really can be characterized as kind of one of the modern miracles of medicine, and quite frankly, it's no longer experimental in most regards, whether it be kidney, which is the most common transplantation, or heart and liver, pancreas and lung, bone marrow, all contribute significantly to the well-being of citizens who have end-stage organ dysfunction. If you think about the cost of the kidney disease population to the Medicare program, it really makes sense to explore other innovative opportunities like kidney transplantation. And that's an area that's been growing and growing and growing. It really has changed not only the long-term trajectory in people in terms of their quality of life, but also the length of their lives. And so from our standpoint, transplantation really isn't a big experiment, as others have characterized in Arizona as part of the discussion. I think there are opportunities for improvement. We have to help include and increase the organ donor pool. People are donating living donors or giving kidneys to family members and loved ones and even those who aren't related. So people are doing everything they can to increase the benefits of transplantation by giving through organ donation. So it's hard to imagine that those kinds of programs would thrive in an environment where people thought it was just an experiment. It really isn't. It's a life-saving, life-enhancing transplant procedure that really makes a difference in people's lives.
In your profession, what are people saying about what sort of impact this decision in Arizona might have in the rest of the states that are facing, you know, let's face it, just about every state out there is facing horrible cuts, funding cuts coming up in the next biennium.
Yeah.
And Medicaid, this is one of the options one of the things that still is an option in the Medicaid menu.
Well, as professionals, we all see it as kind of an unconscionable restriction of access to life-saving procedures to those who may be a little less fortunate than folks who have commercial insurance. And so it really is kind of a rationing of care, which is inappropriate and unacceptable, certainly unprecedented in the United States. We know of many other societies around the world that ration care, and only the rich get transplant procedures or life-saving organ improving procedures. And so I'm not sure we want to go that way, but this is one of the first examples of fiscal priorities being the means by which decisions are made as healthcare is affected. And that's really a very, very slippery slope. And I think you're right. I mean, we're very concerned about what's happening in Ohio from a fiscal standpoint. But this is exactly what the president and other leaders are talking about in terms of access to care and the balancing act between what you can afford and what you need and what you want. So it's a challenging conversation, and I'm not sure there's a right or wrong answer, but I'm not sure that the data they use to make a decision about limiting access to life-saving transplants in Arizona makes sense. And most professional organizations, the American Society for Transplant Surgery, the American Society for Transplantation, made up of thousands of transplant professionals, have uniformly condemned this decision.
How does the screening for transplant candidates work in Ohio?
Well,
I'm not sure screening is the right word.
Evaluation, certainly, yeah, of folks is a comprehensive multidisciplinary process that looks at not only the medical indications for transplantation, but also psychosocial and medical comorbidities, and quite frankly, financial means and ability to not only emotionally but fiscally support the challenges that transplantation presents. you know, getting to the doctor on a regular basis, getting back and forth, taking your medications. Medications are very expensive, going through the testing and such. And most folks with insurance are able to do those things without too many problems. The folks who are below kind of the poverty line or those who don't have resources tend to struggle with it. Ohio State's been a longstanding provider for those who are underprivileged and those who are under the poverty line and those who have Medicaid to provide transplantation services. And I would imagine our leadership is not going to make a decision to withhold life-saving transplant procedures or therapies because folks can't pay for it.
The number that's bandied about in these conversations regarding Arizona is $250,000 to upwards of $350,000 for a transplant. Dumb question. What costs so much?
Well, from A to Z, the workup to make sure that you're medically suitable, you don't have complications and problems, is a process that requires comprehensive testing, evaluation by healthcare professionals. Then the organ procurement process, in order to get an organ, someone's got to pay for it. And so that cost of the organ donation process gets passed on to the hospital and the patient and to their insurance company that pays for, and that's a fee that ends up on the insurance company or the Medicare, Medicaid bill. The post-operative care, the surgical procedure, the operating room, the anesthesiologist, the medical staff and nursing. So it's a comprehensive program, and it requires, you know, top-notch, you know, professionals. You know, only 30,000 transplants are done each year. It's a relatively small piece of the healthcare budget. Yet it has the, you know, vitality of saving lives and improving lives. It's extraordinary. So it's a price that most people, who those 30,000 people, say is well worth the price.
Tiffany, what role do hospitals play in this? Can they lower the cost for patients, or is that already something that they're already doing?
Well, specific to organ transplants, you know, certainly hospitals' overall efforts to reduce infections and improve quality, those are all things that are going to help in the realm of organ transplants. I mean, Dr. Higgins is the clinical expert, so he could speak more to the infections, but I would think that those folks would be at a greater risk for those things. And hospitals know, you know, if you can get people out of the hospital as quickly as is feasible and keep them from coming back in the hospital, that obviously reduces a lot of healthcare dollars, both for the individual and, you know, for the entire system. You know, so that's really a great focus area for hospitals.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. We're all working diligently to prevent those complications after transplantation from extending people's length of stay in the hospital. A very important area.
In Arizona, transplant doctors have been lobbying to propose other cuts associated with the state's transplant funding, including elimination of tests typically conducted before surgery. Are there any way you can do cost-cutting measures with transplants? Is there any way to shrink that cost?
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, I think that we as clinicians wear administrative hats because we know that the I mean, you can't just order a panel of tests and expect, okay, somebody's going to pay for it. I mean, we've got to be accountable for the work that we're doing. And so I think that's part of the evolving knowledge among transplant physicians and other professionals. There are ways to try to curb costs and doing tests as outpatients and maybe not duplicating tests that were done at a referring center. If the data looks good and it's information that you can use to make an evaluation, maybe you don't have to repeat it in your own medical center. There are other cost-saving and, that don't diminish the ability to do transplantation. And we're exploring all of those things. And so I just reviewed abstracts for the American Transplant Congress and had an unprecedented number of papers looking at the economic impact of transplantation and means to improve the sustain the quality and then reduce the financial implications. So I think transplant professionals are looking at this, and I think it's an area that's going to be evolving in terms of our focus.
Tiffany, when folks in your industry heard about what happened in Arizona, was it the sort of thing where you looked at each other and said, it could happen here, or we'll do anything we can to stop it from happening? I mean, how did you respond? How did people react to that?
Well, unfortunately, none of us have a crystal ball when it comes to how healthcare is going to be financed.
Right.
So, you know, I don't know that we can definitively say this is absolutely an option in Ohio or it's not. Certainly, hospitals are, the hospital community is concerned anytime that there is an eligibility.
I can do that.
In Medicaid, because what that means is, you know, just on a basic level, those individuals don't have access to preventive care, and then they'll wait until it's chronic and come to an emergency room, which is mm-hmm. more costly. Certainly, you know, specific to organ transplant, that has a larger implication for quality of life and life-saving and everything that Dr. Higgins talked about. You know, the hospital community is absolutely wanting to keep an eye on this and do what's best for the patients and the community, with the understanding that obviously the state government has a large hole to fill, and that's going to be a challenge.
And I think actually, as healthcare professionals in this transplant field, we do have a responsibility to be accountable. And what I would propose is that we can make a very compelling case for the fact that successful transplant procedures, kidney, heart, do save the state government, the hospitals, the medical infrastructure, thousands of dollars over the course of time mm-hmm. by preventing recurrent hospitalizations for kidney failure or dialysis, or patients being in the hospital for heart failure or lung disease. By successfully transplanting those patients, we know that there's a benefit in terms of survival. And I think we can make a case for the fact that over the course of a period of time, it saves the taxpayer money and the state money. So it's cost effective. And this is the kind of research that needs to be done. This is the kind of message that needs to be delivered so that we can go to the state house and make a convincing and compelling argument to let people know, hey, listen, cutting this out may just end up sending more people to the emergency room and clogging up your hospitals and more cost, as opposed to a life-saving transplant that could be have people out doing their thing and having a great quality of life and not chewing up healthcare dollars and resources in the hospital.
That's Dr. Robert Higgins. He's director of the OSU Medical Center's Comprehensive Transplant Center since July. I hope you are happy for your move, Dr. Higgins.
Oh, it's been great. This is a fantastic place, and people in the state of Ohio and particularly at the Ohio State University and our enterprise have really been very welcoming and warm. It's a great time to be here and very exciting. A lot of hard work to do, as you guys are pointing out. We've got to keep our eye on the ball, but on balance, this place has done close to 7,000 transplants, so I'm privileged to be a shepherd in the process.
That's Dr. Robert Higgins. He's director of the OSU Medical Center's Comprehensive Transplant Center. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Higgins. And also, Tiffany. Sorry, Tiffany Himmelreich. Tiffany, thanks for joining us from the Ohio Hospital Association.
It is my pleasure.
Appreciate it. We'll be right back and continue our conversation with a reporter for Kaiser Health News. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
If you're getting a new computer or electronic device for Christmas, what do you do with the old one? How do you prevent it from being sent to a dump in China or Ghana, where toxins will poison the air and water? On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Jim Puckett, founder of the Basel Action Network, a watchdog group that monitors e-waste. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Listen to WOSU Public Media's new radio service, Classical 101, for classical music 24 hours a day and 7 days a week. Start your day with Boyce Lancaster beginning at 6 a.m. Classical 101 also brings you the Amadeus Deli, Performance Today, Symphony at 7, and much more. For the best in classical music, all day, every day, listen to Classical 101. And for complete program listings, visit wosu.org/classical101.
Support for WOSU comes from City Scene Magazine, Columbus Arts Entertainment and Style Magazine. From art gallery galas to entertainment events, City Scene Magazine is on the scene and online at cityscenecolumbus.com.
It's 27 degrees in downtown Columbus. Cloudy skies today, a high of 34. A chance of a little snow mixing with freezing rain overnight, a low of 27. All Sides continues on WOSU.
Welcome back to All Sides. We've been talking about the state of Arizona's decision to stop funding transplants for uninsured patients there, and also about how Ohio hospitals cope with the cost of care for uninsured patients in general. Now we'll hear a perspective on how the new federal health care law may impact costs for states. Joining us is Mary Agnes Carey. She's a senior correspondent with Kaiser Health News. She most recently served as associate editor for Congressional Quarterly Health Beat, a daily report on health care policy, and has also served as Capitol Hill bureau chief for Congressional Quarterly. Welcome to the show, Mary Agnes.
Thanks for having me.
I was reading something in the Fiscal Times that said, here's the crux of the issue and why it's been getting heated attention in recent days and weeks. Organ transplants are considered optional by the federal government. And in today's economic climate, optional means endangered, which makes you wonder what else is on the chopping block. What else out there is as endangered as this has been in Arizona?
Well, I think the difficulty for states is, as I'm sure you've noted earlier in your program, is the financial cost of Medicaid. And there's been with the recession, there's been so many states whose enrollments have increased for Medicaid. Mm-hmm. And so the federal law requires them to continue benefits at current levels until the expansion in 2014 of Medicaid. And so that means states have to continue to offer what they offered, I believe, as of September the 1st. I think maybe September 1st, 2009, actually. So the problem is for states to continue to offer benefits to all the current enrollees, and as those enrollments grow, they have pushback on their own budgets. They've gotten some money from the federal government to help with that, but states are doing all sorts of things. As you mentioned on the transplant issue, that's one factor. They're looking at some provider cuts. They may trim back some optional benefits. They're doing everything they can to keep all the balls in the air and take care of all the current beneficiaries.
So when they have to keep offering Medicaid, what they're saying is they have to keep offering the basic package.
Right, exactly. The technical term is called a maintenance of effort. The federal government didn't want any states to drop people off the Medicaid rolls in advance of the expansion, and so this was one of the requirements they put into the law.
And the provider cuts, though, the more provider cuts they make, isn't it the fewer providers serve Medicaid patients?
Well, that's the argument, and that's a concern because in 2014, the federal law expands Medicaid to everyone up to 133% of the poverty level. For individuals, that's about $14,400, and for a family of four, it's just a little under $30,000. So if you're going to expand access to Medicaid, and if you have fewer providers, in part because of reimbursement changes, that could definitely create a problem.
Arizona Governor Jan Brewer blamed the need to cut funding for transplants on the federal health care reform. Now, that notion's been largely debunked, that it was that this, you know, that they don't match up time-wise, right?
Right. Now, I mean, the federal government Congress has stepped up to try to give governors more money to deal with their current caseloads. And the expanded population, the federal government's going to cover like 96% of that cost. And so the idea that they're throwing a lot of costs, excessive costs on the state, has been challenged successfully so.
Our guest is Mary Agnes Carey. She's a senior correspondent with Kaiser Health News, former Capitol Hill bureau chief for Congressional Quarterly. If you have a question or comment for her, we're talking about the impact on the states as far as the federal health care reform goes. So give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. If you have a question about health care costs for the states, you know Ohio is facing that $8 billion budget shortfall, Mary Agnes, and you have to wonder in a place like Ohio where they're struggling so mightily with the budget and there's a balanced budget requirement, if this could happen here too, if these sorts of things could happen here too. Is this what states are talking about? Is this on the table for many states?
Absolutely, absolutely, because they have to. Medicaid for a lot of states is right behind education and cost. It's a huge budget item, and so they want to look at it, and if they're not going to cut benefits or cut provider payments, they might put in more a utilization review, more closer examination and monitoring of the claims. The fact that it's consuming so much of their budgets just commands so many states to look very closely at Medicaid and see where they can trim.
What's the politics of the states that are lining up against the health care reform law? What's happening with all of those efforts?
They tend to be Republican. They tend to talk about the health law as a government takeover. Many of them have challenged the law on constitutional grounds that Congress does not have the power to require most individuals to, as the law would command, purchase a health insurance coverage by 2014 or pay a fine. But as we know from the court cases, some of the rulings that are coming out, that they'll be they've had some rulings saying that Congress has the power to do it, and they've had other rulings saying Congress does not. So these legal challenges are going to continue. Supreme Court could look at that case possibly summer of 2012 or summer of 2013. But separately, states have to continue to implement the law because it still is in place.
So what's coming up in January as far as implementing the law?
Well, in January, there'll be several things that will go into effect. There are many elements in the law that became effective for plan years after September 23rd, and for many of us, that begins January 1st. So, for example, that's these items of allowing an adult child to stay on your health insurance until age 26, or the prohibition of a practice called rescissions, which is canceling health insurance once you get sick unless you've committed fraud, no lifetime limits on your policies. A lot of these elements will become applicable to more consumers. And also, there'll be the laying of the foundation, if you will, for further implementation in Medicare, in Medicaid, in the state exchanges, these marketplaces that will go into action in 2014, where people can shop for health insurance. There's tax credits for small business. There are a lot of elements that are coming that have come online and will apply to more people, and other provisions of the law that will continue to go forth in 2011 as implementation continues.
Aren't things like those lifetime limits and some of those other restrictions that are going to now be banned in health insurance policies, aren't they behind why a lot of people wind up on these waiting lists, or a lot of these people that can't afford to get the transplants themselves that are uninsured is because they've been taken off other policies?
Right. That's right. You never really know. Most people don't know if they even have a lifetime limit until they get close to hitting it. But so many people, Medicaid funds so many of these transplants because people have had a medical bankruptcy, because they've had a chronic condition that has cost a lot. They've hit their lifetime limit. They don't have other financing, and so they go into the Medicaid program. So that's exactly right.
They might have gotten laid off from a job, and when they go to get another job somewhere else, they can't get.
That's right. They may say, well, we won't cover your kidney problems for a year or 18 months, or they may put other restrictions there, and that creates problems. There are some people that simply change jobs, not because they want to, but because they've hit their lifetime cap at their current employer. And so the thought is that by outlawing lifetime caps on policies, that problem will go away for the people for which it's such a major issue.
Give us a call, 614-292-8513. My guest is Mary Agnes Carey, Kaiser Health News Correspondent. If you want to go talk to us by email, allsides@wosu.org, or you can go to our All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. Mary Agnes, some complain that federal rigidity is going to be a huge problem in the next 2 years as states grapple with their budget shortfalls.
Well, there's some that's an interesting conversation to have, because in Medicaid you do have a standard benefits package. Now, states can always apply for a waiver to the Department of Health and Human Services, and Kathleen Sebelius, the Secretary of HHS, can make that decision. As far as the rest of the health law, states do have quite a bit of flexibility in implementing how they do exchanges, how they can look at insurance rates. Some states have the ability to go to an insurer and say this rate is unacceptable and you have to lower it. They have power to decide which insurers are allowed in the exchange or which are not. So states have a phenomenal role in implementation of the health law, and I think this is overlooked a lot. They will have federal minimums they have to meet. For example, HHS is now developing this benefits package that will be the sort of baseline package, if you will, that insurers will have to meet, and they could certainly go above it. But within that, states have a phenomenal amount of flexibility.
You did an interview with Democratic Senator Ron Wyden,
right,
about alternative state plans to health care reform. What's that about?
What he wants to do is, in the law, he pushed to get a provision that said by 2017, states could get could opt out of, get a waiver to be freed of some of the requirements of the health law if they met certain provisions, right? So they could show we don't need an individual mandate and we can still get the same level of coverage. We don't need to do certain things in certain ways mandated by the federal law. Now, what he wants to do, and he's got a co-sponsor, he has Scott Brown of Massachusetts, who's a Republican.
The new senator there.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. They want to move that up to 2014 because he really, Senator Wyden really believes that governors are going to be the engine pushing for the flexibility. But on the flip side, Republicans will tell you this really isn't much of a waiver. You still have to satisfy a lot of the requirements of the bill. You still have to hit the same coverage target that the individual mandate would attain, which I believe is about 95%. So the counterargument is it's not much freedom. But to your point, I think governors, because of budget pressures, are looking for flexibility and innovative ways. And the states are often the laboratories on health care and a lot of other things. So if a state, if a legislature and a governor can get together and find out a way to meet the coverage targets, to meet the coverage levels, to get more people onto the private insurance or in a Medicaid program, they can get the flexibility. And again, it's the Secretary of HHS here that would make this decision. And right now we have a Democratic president and a Democratic administration, but think if you had a Republican in the White House in 2012, or if Republicans took back both chambers in the next election, you could have a Republican Secretary of Health and Human Services, and the type of waivers they could grant would be very different than the current administration.
In Massachusetts, do they already have what would qualify as an alternative state plan?
Well, that's a good question. It would be probably maybe up to the purview of the Secretary of HHS to make that decision, but mm-hmm. they've certainly got the groundwork. They've had their success. They've had their failures, but they're certainly one of the states that's out in front and running far ahead of others.
You know, in a few years, we could have a Republican administration, but we know coming up in January, we will have a Republican-controlled House.
Right.
And a narrow enough margin in the Senate, it's a battleground, continue to be a fierce battleground. There have been threats to, they can't necessarily stop the reforms from going through, but they could stop funding them. There's other things they could do. Are those threats still out there, and what do you expect to see on the horizon in that way?
They're absolutely out there, but one thing I learned when I was new to Washington is on Capitol Hill, it's all about the votes. Now, mm-hmm. the Republicans are going to have the votes in the House of Representatives. I'm sure they will successfully have a repeal vote. They'll have all sorts of, as you mentioned, votes to defund, to starve the implementation from cash, you know, mm-hmm. as far as the appropriations process goes. You'll probably have a lot of examination of the Medicaid expansion, of the subsidies and the exchanges and so on. But the problem is when it gets to the Senate, it's probably not going to have that magic number, which is 60 votes. Even though Republicans have picked up, I think it's about 8 or 9 seats, they're not going to hit the 60 number. And then even if it did survive the Senate, President Obama will most certainly veto anything that he views as a serious threat to implementation of the law. And there are not votes in either chamber to override. So that's kind of the Washington game, that they won't succeed. But I think what's worth watching is how does the public take this all in? What does it mean to the public if the House of Representatives, as expected, passes a repeal of the health law? I think people will get confused. They'll wonder about what's happening. People don't necessarily follow that kind of ping pong that the Washington reporters and so on follow. Mm-hmm. What the House does, what the Senate does, is there an override, does the president veto? And I think that Republicans, with their majority in the House of Representatives, are just going to go gangbusters on the floor of the House, pushing legislation to hurt the bill. You're going to have a lot of oversight hearings. There are committees on Capitol Hill that their mission is oversight, and they're going to be calling in Secretary Sebelius. They'll call in Don Berwick, who's the head of Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. That's the person who, you know, they run the Medicare and Medicaid programs. There'll be a lot of examination of implementation so far, implementation in the future, and they're going to do their best, they being Republicans, to win this public relations game.
You know, as far as the public is concerned, a lot of it depends on whether they perceive themselves as having something to lose at this point. And I was wondering about how much the public has availed itself of the changes that are already underway. For instance, having previously ill children, they can get them back on their policies now. They can't keep them. Things like that.
Well, the Democrats are really hoping that as the January 1st comes, and for many of us, that's the beginning of our health insurance plan year.
Right.
That as that happens, more and more Americans will either benefit from these elements of the health law or they'll know someone who did. An example one Democratic strategist gave to me is of looking back sort of in history of the Family Medical Leave Act. When it was passed, didn't seem to be that big of a deal. People didn't really understand it, what was in it for them. But as time went on, maybe they had a sick relative, and they used that law to be able to take time off work and keep their job, or someone wanted to stay home with a child, so on. That the hope from the Democrats is that the public will begin to embrace the law more once they see more elements of it and benefit from it.
We just have a few more minutes. My guest is Mary Agnes Carey. She's Kaiser Health News correspondent in Washington. If you have a question or comment, get it in real quick. Don't wait till the last minute, like you sometimes do. Are there any coalitions that are forming in Washington, new coalitions to in regards to the health care and health care funding? I know insurance companies, strangely, just from talking to Ken Rudin at NPR, they haven't been as much against this as people might have thought they would be.
Well, they stand to benefit a lot. I mean, you're talking about over 30 million new customers. You're talking about all sorts of new markets they can go into. One thing they've been worried about, and again, this is something worth watching, and implementation goes forward, is the way that this individual mandate is structured. Again, it's a requirement that most Americans buy coverage by 2014 or pay a fine, but the fine is minimal. It's very small, like $95 the first year, right? And it goes up to, I think, $695 for an individual, and then it's a percentage of family income if there are several people in the household. But insurers had really hoped for a very strong and rigorous mandate. That's one of those provisions that when they do polling, people are unhappy about. They may like the idea they can keep their child up to 26 on their health insurance, but they don't like the idea that the government's saying you have to buy health insurance. And so if that were to be changed or weakened or taken out of the bill, you would find the insurance industry extremely unhappy about it because they're worried that if you don't have a mandate, people are going to get in and out of coverage, come in when they're sick, drop it when they're healthy, and that you won't have that large risk pool of the healthy individuals and the sick individuals to balance out costs. So while they've certainly pushed for a strong mandate, there are taxes on the industry they don't like. Wouldn't surprise me to see them pushing back against those before they go into place. But they have definitely, there's a lot for them to gain here.
Paul, you're on the air.
I got 2 seconds.
You know.
Okay.
Know the drill.
My recommendation is that all members of Congress should go out into the individual market without the, you know, the federal subsidies and all that they get and try to buy insurance for themselves and their families. We would see a sea change overnight.
That thanks, Paul, for your call.
Right.
That's been talked about, Mary Agnes.
Right.
How does that play out now these days?
Well, I've heard people say this. I've had friends of mine, Republican strategists, who now have to buy insurance on their own. They've said the same thing. If every member of Congress had to go into the individual market and look at those prices and look at those caveats, we will cover this, we won't cover that, that you would have no problem whatsoever with having a public option or a national insurance program. Members of Congress have the same program that federal employees get, and a percentage of the premium is paid. They're in a very large pool with a lot of choices, and a lot of people say, why can't the rest of the country get what Congress has?
That is all the time we have. I want to thank Mary Agnes Carey of Kaiser Health News for joining us. Thanks, Mary Agnes.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820 NPR News.